Tommy, Tom Esker. Tom Esker. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world.
As Arthur Godfrey used to say, it's Terrible Tommy here in the bunker, right beneath the great soil of northern Indiana, where they're pouring all kinds of toxic material and chemicals all over the fields to grow corn big and tall that's got no food value, and then sell it out and ship it out to the third world. It's crazy, man. It's totally crazy. People are getting all kinds of diseases and everything else from this toxic shit. Roundup's one of the worst, but I hear them advertising other kinds now that I've never heard of because we're in a farmer area. At least the closest field that's been treated with all that obnoxious stuff is about a half a mile away. And so the rest on all three sides is woods and grasslands, so maybe I'm somewhat protected. But when I drive up by that field and go by, I hold my breath until I get out of there. Yeah. Hey, it is the 23rd of June 2016, and that's going to be a great day, I'm telling you. If you got up this morning and there was no flowers around your bed, it's going to be a great day. We had another ball buster around here last night. Boy, a light show like you wouldn't believe. Thor and all of them were running around up in the sky and battling and hitting each other with swords and everything. And in fact, long towards morning, about the time I got up at 6:30, the power went off. So wouldn't you know, I didn't have a portable radio handy with batteries in it. Well, I did, but by the time I found it and started looking around, all I could get is damn preachers. Preachers and rock and roll and crap like that. Sports, you know. Nobody was telling what's going on. So I calls the sheriff's department, you know. The guy who should know. The gal says, well, you got to call the power company. I said, well, I know what's going to happen when I call the power company. They're going to have take their phone off the hook because they're so busy. So I'm not going to know nothing. Oh, sorry, sir. So I call the other line in the sheriff's department. I ask the gal, yeah, there's some outages. Thanks a lot. So I don't know what exactly caused the outage, but it was only out about an hour or so, so it came back on. So, but I'm telling you, you got to keep a little portable radio around with batteries in it, or a scanner or something like that. Unfortunately, I didn't have a battery supply on my scanner, so I got to get a line that I can plug that into one of, you know, you can plug things into these car battery jumper boxes. If you don't have one, you should have one. A jumper box for jumping your battery if it goes down. And they have a couple of inputs on them, and you can put adapter plugs to go from your little radio if your radio takes like 12 volts. And so you can plug it right in there. So you've got one of those sitting around. You've got some kind of a backup information coming in. I don't like to sit here and not know what the hell don't know. Somebody said they saw a tornado down south of us. I don't know. I don't think it was a true tornado. I don't think it hit the ground, but tore up a lot of crap. Boy, I'll tell you. You know, Mother Nature loves to trim the trees. And every time we get one of these big rainstorms and winds come through, it takes me about an hour or two to clean up all the little dead branches that have fallen off these giant. I got giant trees here that are over 50 feet high. Yeah. And so in the morning, I'm out there picking all that stuff up, you know. That's a good thing, because nature knows when the limbs are bad or rotted or dead, and it's time for them to come down. So we'll just huff and puff. Mother Nature blow those damn things out of there. I do feel sorry for the birds, because after every time one of these big rainstorms comes through, I find dead birds around. Not a whole lot of them, but, you know, but that's Mother Nature weeding out the weak, too, or the unfortunate. Well, let's see what the hell's going on here. They're up to no good as usual, that's for sure. I was talking to a guy in another state about my cable service here. He handled my cable service from West Virginia. I said, you know, I was talking about our sheriff. I called the sheriff. The sheriff's been indicted here for felonies. Yeah, and half the cops are up on charges. So you can't get much information from those boys. I think it might be a good time for old Terrible Tommy to run for sheriff. How about that? Well, it's time to go back to my favorite book, and we're about halfway through it, The Pessimist's Guide to History. And it's a damn good book. Makes you feel real good that you're not in these terrible situations, like in this book. After I read stuff out of this book, I feel damn good that we just got a rainstorm came through. 1876, Brooklyn, New York theater fire. Shrieks of fire echoed through the hall as actors in the Brooklyn theater on the evening of December 5th kept their composure, pleading with the 900 theater goers present to leave calmly, but the audience watched with growing alarm as the flames consumed the theater curtain. Lacking water or firefighting equipment, stagehands vainly tried beating out the fire, apparently started when a lamp ignited a backstage curtain. Though the flames spread rapidly, those members of the audience in the orchestra section made a fairly orderly exit. However, hundreds in the upper galleries panicked, rushed madly for exits and crushing those who blocked the way. Some husbands whose wives had fainted carried the women to safety on over their heads to prevent their being trampled. Despite such heroic rescue efforts, the fire killed 295 people. But they never changed. The crowd never changes. The technology changes. You know, politics change, but people basically don't change. And they always panic. Just as much today as they did back then. And if you're around a bunch of people and they begin to panic, you're in trouble. Get away from the crowd. 1876, Ohio train wreck, slowed by a terrible blizzard on the night of December 29th. The West Coast bound 11-car Pacific Express carrying 150 passengers crept out into an iron bridge just outside of Ashtabula, Ohio. About 8 p.m., when the train on the bridge, there came a sudden, heart-stopping crack as the entire 160-foot span collapsed. Passengers barely had time to realize the horror that was happening before the train plunged 75 feet into the frozen Ashtabula Creek below. Minutes after the fall, overturned heating stoves set fire to the wrecked passenger cars, even as icy creek waters bubbled in from underneath. The terrified passengers, lucky enough to survive the fall, the fire, and the freezing water, still had to face the blinding snowstorm. And before the night was over, 92 people had died. 1878, it got pretty shitty in Memphis. Yellow fever epidemic in Memphis, Tennessee. Already on the decline after the Civil War, Memphis, Tennessee suffered another devastating setback when the yellow fever epidemic broke out in mid-August. See, that's another byproduct of war that people don't talk about, is disease and pestilence usually that either follows the war or erupts within the war. Every major war, you have these epidemics. So you got to add all the people who die of these diseases, not just the soldiers killed, and not just the collateral damage. Little was known about the disease then, except it was deadly and spread rapidly. By early September, some 25,000 people had fled the city out of fear of contracting the disease, thereby turning Memphis into a virtual ghost town and helping to spread the disease throughout the South. Of the remaining 20,000 who stayed in Memphis, some 17,000 did contract the fever, and 5,000 of them died of it. Doctors, priests, and others who remained risked their own lives to care for the sick and dying. One local madam sent away her girls and cared for patients in her bordello before succumbing to the fever herself. Citizen militias, meanwhile, attempted to stem the rising tide of robberies and public disorder. The epidemic finally ended in October, soon after the fall's first cold snap hit the South. But by this time, some 14,000 people had already died from the yellow fever in Memphis, New Orleans, and other parts of the South. Like I say, another product of war. 1878, sinking of the excursion steamer. The Princess Alice sank bow first in a matter of minutes after being hit amidship by the Collier Bywell Castle ship near Woolwich, England, on September 3rd. 645 people, many women and children, died. Well, that's enough good news. I mean, that's enough bad news for now. We'll get back with all these tragedies as time goes on. Let me bookmark my place so I don't read the same thing to you over and over again, which I've been known to do. Okay, where am I at? Okay, somebody sent me something here. They said I should read. Oh, this is not very good news. They had been expecting a full procession with a limousine and police escort, but the limousine never came and the police officer was called away to a suspected drug overdose at the last minute. that left 40 friends and relatives of Anna Marie Jones stranded outside the funeral home, waiting for instructions from the mortician about what to do next. An uncle of Anna's went to his truck and changed from khakis to coveralls, or overalls. A niece ducked behind the hearse to light her cigarette in the stiff Oklahoma wind. Why are so many working-class women in rural America dying of middle age? These are white women, asked journalist Eli Cecil. Addiction, suicide, and an epidemic of despair. Quote, just one more thing for Mom that didn't go as planned, said Timothy Edwards, the youngest surviving daughter. She climbed into her truck, put on the flashers, and motioned for everyone else to follow behind in their own cars. They formed a makeshift procession of dented pickups, diesel exhaust, driving out of town into dirt roads and up to a tiny cemetery bordered by cattle grazing fields. In the back there was a fresh plot marked by a plastic sign. Anna Marie Jones, born 1961, died 2016. 54 years old, raised on 3 rural acres, high school educated, a mother of 3, loyal employee of Kmart, Wall's Bargain Center, and the Dollar Store. These were the facts of her life as printed in the funeral program, and now they had also become clues to the American crisis, with implications far beyond the burnt grass and red dirt of central Oklahoma. White women between 25 and 55 have been dying at an accelerated rate over the past decades. A spike in mortality not seen since the AIDS epidemic in the early 1980s. According to recent studies, the death certificates, the trend is worse for women in the center of the United States. Worse still in rural areas, and worst of all for those in the lower middle class, of which millions of white people and white women are getting into. Drug and alcohol overdose rates for working-age white women have quadrupled. Suicides are up by as much as 50%. What killed Jones was cirrhosis of the liver, brought on by heavy drinking. The exact culprit was vodka, whatever brand was on sale, poured into a pint glass 8 ounces at a time. But as Anna's family gathered at the gravesite, they wondered instead about the root causes, which were harder to diagnose and more difficult to solve. Quote, life didn't always break her way. She dealt with that sadness, but Candy Payne, the funeral officiant, she tried her best. She loved her family, but she dabbled in the drinking, and when things got tough, the drinking made it harder. There were plots nearby marked for Jones' friends and relatives who had died in the past decade at ages 46, 52, and 37. Jones had buried her fiancé dead at 55. She had eulogized her best friend, dead at 50, from alcohol-induced cirrhosis. Other parts of the adjacent land were intended for her children, Davy, 38, her oldest son and most loyal caretaker, who was making it through the day with some of his mother's vodka. Mary Ann, 33, the middle daughter who had hitched a ride to the service because she couldn't afford a working car. And Tiffany, 31, who had 2 daughters of her own, a job at the discount grocery, and enough accumulated stress to make her feel at least a decade or 2 older than she was. Candy, who in addition to being efficient, was also a close family friend, motioned to Tiffany and Mary Ann to bring over the container holding her mother's cremated remains. They opened the lid and the ashes blew back on their dresses and out into the pasture. All anyone else had so far was a question, one that has also become the focal point of congressional hearings, health summits, and presidential debates. Why? Why, after 50 years of progress in life expectancy for every conceivable group of Americans, men, women, young, old, rich, poor, high school dropouts, college graduates, rural, urban, white, black, Hispanic, or Asian, had one demographic group in the past decades experienced a significant percent increase in premature deaths? Why were so many white women reporting precipitous drops in physical health, mental health, comfort, and mobility during their working age prime? Why, over the past 8 years alone, had more than 300,000 of these women essentially chosen to poison themselves? It is a loss of hope, a loss of expectations of progress from one generation to the next, said Angus Deaton, a Nobel Prize-winning economist who had studied the data. What we're seeing is a strain of inequality of the middle class, President Obama said. Erosion of the safety net, Hillary Clinton said. Depression caused by the state of our country, Donald Trump said. Isolated rural communities, Bernie Sanders said. Addictive pain pills and narcotics, Marco Rubio said. There were so many paths in the America of 2016 to what coroners termed a premature and unnatural death. And one version was what had happened to Jones, another night of drinking that ended in the emergency room, her seventh trip in the past 4 years, a diagnosis of end-stage liver failure, a week in a nursing home, a quiet death followed by burial 4 days later. She had been born on the way to the hospital in the back seat of her father's car, the ninth of 10 children, and the family joke was that Anna had never stopped hurdling her way into the world. At a time when life on the far edges of the middle class came from dependable opportunities, her older siblings left home for the quarry. Hold it. Hold it. The machine shop and the military, and Anna moved right out along with them. Even though she was only 17, she rushed off to get married in Reno, Nevada. She got a job at Kmart Snack Bar in California and worked her way up to manager. She was good at making people feel comfortable, at listening without judgment and aligning herself with the customer. She clipped coupons for regular and gave free drinks to people who couldn't afford them. By the time she reached her mid-20s, Kmart was training her to become a regional manager. She had her own trailer in Ferndale, California, 2 children, 2 cars, and a retirement savings account. But the promotion never materialized, and the marriage took work. And after a while, her eagerness turned to restlessness. She drank more. She tried drugs. She left Kmart. She was arrested for drinking and for failing to pay her taxes. Her marriage unraveled, and she moved home to Oklahoma with the kids. She helped push Mary Ann and Tiffany to finish high school, and then, once all her children left home, she lived for a while with her mother, then her daughter, then her fiancé, and finally her son for the last years of her life. Sometimes the hard things in life eventually break you, said Caitlin, Anna's friend. Well, you see where this is going, and it's about another page in this article. It's pretty grim. This is the way they're killing you off, and you're cooperating with committing suicide. Millions of white working class people. And so it's not just the birth rate that's way down, it's the death rate that's way up. Boys and girls, we're up against the wall, and we're going to have to start swinging sooner or later, or there won't be anything to swing. Just thought I'd run that past you. You see, it's called population change. They don't give a shit about white people, even though white people tend to be superior, a large percentage of them. They don't need superior people. They just need people who follow orders and put the bolt in the hole, you know, if you've got a bolt and if you've got a hole. Yeah, right. So you're being poisoned, and you're willingly cooperating in that poisoning. They're poisoning the ground. They're poisoning the things you drink. They're shoving sugar drinks into you. You're becoming 200, 300 pound fat. It's a form of genocide, and you don't even see it. People don't even recognize it. They think they're in hog heaven. I see them going around the curve on my road every morning to work. Big, fat, obese people. Cell phone in their ear. Cigarettes in their mouth. Yeah, and when they come home, I see beer cans laying all over the side of the road. Yep, that's the way it is now. So when they accuse you of being a hater, say, you're goddamn right I'm a hater, because I know the people that are pulling this shit off. I know exactly who they are, I know their names, and I know generally where they live. And I don't know whether it'll ever get done, but I hope that the day will come when things are put right. And when I mean put right, guillotine right. Shove a lot of those corporate leaders and people like that into solitary confinement like they do the white boys. Like they put white boys in solitary confinement for years. Can you imagine being in solitary confinement for 10, 20 years? That goes on all the time. They talk about the Russian gulags. Well, we got the gulags are right here. I talk to these people. They write me all the time from prison and tell me what's going on. But Hillary, the zombie queen of the untouchables, she'll take care of you. Sure. Or Ronald McDonald, he's going to build a wall. Yeah, or Bernie the Kike, he wants to help a lot of people who I don't think are too white. But at least he goes after the big shots, the 1 or 2% that control most of the money. And the thing I can't understand is the middle class, what's left of it, that go crazy whenever they talk about raising the taxes on these big billionaires. Why in the hell would an intelligent middle class person defend the autocrats at the top? What the hell's that all about? Unless they think that they might be able, if they're crooked enough and kill enough people, they might be able to rise to the top too. Maybe that's all that's in their mind. Give me a break. I want to be a billionaire too, and I'll do anything to do it. You know, when I get pissed off and a little down, I don't go to the Bible. I don't go to the Judaism Bible. I don't go even to a lot of the history books. And I don't go to the Constitution. And I don't go to the Bill of Rights. You know where I go to? I go to Ragnar Redbeard. It's all that makes sense.
Common people are lost souls.
Sense.
Common people are lost souls.
Its name and the harmless privilege the common people have of scolding the proprietors in vulgar editorial diatribes at or about election times. Occasionally they do descend into the streets, indulging in sanguinary vociferations upon the same general principle that impels a mangy cur to howl most dismally, if struck with a brick. The conflict between the masters and the helots is over for the present, and the masters, having conquered, are in possession of the booty and the field. Ha! The songs of victory, the flap of the battle pennons. Indeed, considering all the circumstances, the common people are lost souls. No matter what they now do, they must remain in hell. The position is that of a worm trying to escape from its hole in a heated, burning log. If it runs to the right, it runs into heat and smoke, and if it runs to the left, it runs into blazes. A few minutes more, and it is roasted alive. Even should America's servile multitudes appeal to the arbitrament of physical force, they cannot possibly win. Possessing neither the strength, courage, brains, arms, money, nor leaders, they must be blown into eternal fragments by their masters, highly trained artillerists, and scientific destroyers. 6. The citadel of power is now consolidated and prepared with the most improved armaments to repel any assault, no matter how well sustained. The nation is intersected in all directions with iron high roads and splendid waterways, whereon armies and navies may be moved from city to city with facility and dread effect. The War of Secession, or rather the War for the Annihilation of Self-Government, demonstrated conclusively that a centralized authority resting on herd votes of the vulgar and fanatic is, in practice, military absolutism. There is no other power in the land that can effectively hold it in check. The Tsar of Russia possesses less actual authority than our federal government. With a standing army in the hollow of its hands, it can do exactly as it pleases. In example, if it can collect enough revenue to purchase statesmen and pay the salaries of its Praetorian cohorts. Most Americans are only now beginning to perceive these things, but they were foreseen and also foretold in part by clear-sighted individuals before the Constitution itself was formally enthroned. Today, all the old Sphinx questions are up again for solution. No man of balanced sense can honestly believe that these problems are to be settled by ballot box stuffing or editorialism. Settled they must be upon the good old rule, the simple plan, and thereafter settled and resettled again and again. For there is no finality in social adjustments, and there should not be. Material strength is the basis of all human greatness, and material strength must settle the tyranny of the greatest number, probably with fire and steel. All other theories are chimeras, lies, delusions, make-believe, and of no account. The philosophy of power has slumbered long, but whenever men of sterling worth are found, it must again sweep away the ignoble dollar-damned peddlerisms of today and openly, as of old, dominate the destiny of an emancipated and all-conquering race. What is viler than a government of slaves and usurious Jews? What is grander than a government of the noblest and the best, who have proved their fitness on the plains of death? Cromwell and his Ironsides, Caesar and his legions shall be born again, and the thunderous tread of Sulla's fierce destroyers shall roll and rumble amid the fire and glare and smoke of crumbling constitutionalisms, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, warfare without end. Yapping politicians may harangue base city mobs of hirelings and Christlings with, alas, poor Yorick, rhapsody as if struggle and strife were the evil of all evils. Figures of speech, however, cannot breathe the breath of life into feline philosophies that never have had the slightest foundation in fact. The survival of the fittest, the toughest, is the logic of events and of all time. They who declare otherwise are blind. The chief point is this, that fitness must honestly demonstrate itself not by ignoble theft in theory, but by open conflict as per Darwin's law of battle. How can citizens be honestly described as free and equal who are not, who never were, free and equal in any reasonable sense of the phrase? How can they be even considered men, whose whole lives are governed by cast-iron regulations, whose every movement is circumscribed and restrained by penal threats, even whose secret thoughts are in a constant state of silent repression? It is no apology whatever to affirm that the people themselves enact all laws they are commanded to obey. Even that statement is a falsity, and if it were true, it would not justify majority dictatorship or any other kind of dictatorship. The Constitution under which all other laws are born was accepted not by us, but by bewigged individuals who are long since rotten. We are ruled, in fact, by cadavers, the inhabitants of tombs. Why should agreements made by coffin dead men bind and mortgage living, pulsing, breathing beings? The Constitution, under which all other laws are born, was accepted not by us, but by bewigged individuals who are long since rotten. We are ruled, in fact, by cadavers, the inhabitants of tombs. Why should agreements made by coffin-dead men bind and mortgage living, pulsing, breathing beings? Their bones have long ago molded into ozone and fertilizers. Who drew up and signed the Bill of Rights, Magna Carta, the Sermon on the Mount, the Declaration of Independence, our glorious Constitution, etc., etc. Rotten are the brains that concocted them and the fingers that signed and sealed them. Equally rotten are their irrational and infantile philosophies. Rotten also in their heart are the men who obey, under compulsion, voices from the tomb. No doubt those old documents served their purpose at the time, but new occasions teach new duties, and new ages require not only new leaders, but new deeds. Again, most acts of Congress are the Machiavellian work of eminent rogues. Curse them whose very names are almost forgotten except by partisan chroniclers and printers of public school histories. As for the common law, it is an inheritance from those interesting old days when Saxon and Norman earls, they were genuine noblemen then, for they had won their position by risking their lives in battle, administered justice direct per media of knotted clubs, halted knives, and long-handled cleavers. That was the only kind of law understood by our uncivilized forefathers, for they had not been educated into the profound convictions that governments and laws derive all their just powers from the consent of the governed. Such an expression would have sent them into convulsions, and he who uttered it would be considered a most excellent fool. No doubt our ancestors were somewhat rude in their manners, somewhat deficient in sweetness and culture, but in matters of frozen fact they were decidedly logical. They did not sneak to public meetings and swagger about liberty, justice, and equality of opportunity, or rights of man when they knew full well that not only their lives, but everything they nominally possessed was by leave of their conquerors and proprietors. They accepted their position pro tem, and when again ready, honestly re-entered the doom ring to test anew their fate. If they could come alive again, how those old pirates and freebooters would stare in shame and scorn at the sight of their tenderfoot posterity, walking up in solemn, horny-handed, hump-backed procession in shoddy rags before an idol altar called a ballot box, dropping into its gilded maw, printed invocations for justice, mercy, liberty, peace in our time, O Lord, protection, cheap money, more laws, more laws, more laws. How our blonde, clean-limbed ancestors would guffaw. Indeed, they would probably keep on guffawing till they guffawed themselves to death again. Oh, they would say, to think that our seed should have sunk so low. 7. But equality before the law is all we mean, whimpers the everlasting sophist, the cunning liar. Let us see. By what rational method can any two litigants be placed in a position of unconditional equality before the law? First of all, plaintiff and defendant always possess totally different physical and mental characteristics, different personal magnetisms, and different sized bank balances. Also, all judges, juries, and legal officials are unequals in temperament, ability, courage, and honesty. Each one has his own peculiar idiosyncrasies, prejudices, inferiorities, superstitions, and price. Each again may be more or less dishonest and more or less subject to financial pressure or caste bias. No two men are born alike, each one being literally born under his own particular star, formed of different material, swayed by different ideals, educated and molded in a different mill by a different process. Even if all tribunals of justice were founded upon blind impartiality and administered free of cost, it would be plainly seen that equality before the law remains a mere chimera, a dream, and of no real value. Equality before the law is just a meaningless catchword, something like that famous Jesuitism, liberty regulated by law. Statute law may formally counter equal rights. Statute law may formally confer equal rights and privileges upon unequal citizens, but it cannot enforce itself. It must execute its mandate through human media, and that media is full up to the brim with superiorities, inferiorities, and inequalities. No legalism has ever been devised that strength cannot drive its coach and fore through, and it is a popular proverb in all lands that somehow there is one law for the rich and another for the poor. Indeed, the poor can never be placed upon an equality with the rich, not even by the pillage of the rich. Whether they are the fittest or not, the present proprietors of wealth should never permit themselves to be plundered without a savage struggle. Sooner or later, the hour of this struggle in its acute form shall arrive, but the rich must not dread it. If they prepare in time, the result shall not only justify their mastership, but render it impregnable, if they are fit. To be respected and secure, aristocracies must rest themselves upon sordid might, not upon paper credits, consuls, and bond issues. Should the opulence be conquered and pillaged, that in itself will be conclusive evidence that they are neither the fittest nor the best. Upon this earth there is no such thing as equal justice. All legal tribunals are based not upon ideal concepts of justice and fair play, but upon effective armed strength. This is a truism. Robbery under arms laid the cornerstone of every courthouse in Christendom and elsewhere. How then can the robbers and the robbed, the eagle and the pigeon, the chicken and the hawk be placed in positions of genuine equilibrium before removable officials, specially paid and appointed to vindicate the law? That is to give forcible effect to the dicta of the strongest. All judges are authorized avengers armed to the teeth, and all hangmen are licensed assassins trained to kill. These words are not spoken in disparagement, assassins and avengers, ha, if that be so. Truly they that seek the Lord do suffer hunger, but lions seek for prey. When an army of occupation settles down upon an enemy's territory, it issues certain rules of procedure for the orderly transference of the property and persons of the conquered into the absolute possession and unlimited control of the conquerors. These rules of procedure may at first take shape as orders issued by military generals, but after a time they develop themselves into statute books, precedents, and constitutions. Indeed, all law is now and ever has been the mandate of successful belligerents, or rather the mandate of the few masterful personalities that ever inspire them. Equality before the law is thus a contradiction in terms, for law itself is an incarnation of inequality. It is true only in the subjective sense that all who obey the law are equally the servants of those who make it or caused it to be made. Drumhead court-martials are really law courts in embryo. Congresses and parliaments are merely committees of rapacious tax-gatherers. Legislators may describe themselves as representatives of the people, but that is only a cunning masquerade. Their chief vocation is to strengthen the law, uphold the Constitution, vote the annual appropriations, and devise ways and means of exploiting the nation or of permitting it to be systematically looted by their accomplices or their masters. The principles that govern a holdup are the selfsame principles that govern government. No government on earth rests on the consent of the governed. It is reasonable, therefore, for a confederation of masterful bandits to place themselves in positions of absolute equality before their intended victims. The idea is absurd on the face of it. Brigandage necessitates inequality, and every government on earth is organized and enthroned brigandage. Las Casas, the Spanish Jesuit, was the first in America to spread about the false, subversive, and shameful theory of equal human rights. But since his time, it has been boastfully accepted on all sides by vast hordes of witless persons who are in all countries the numerical majority. The race of fools, as Plato sagaciously remarked, is not to be counted, not even in this land of the free. Although equality, in any shape, has never been scientifically proven nor logically defended, nevertheless it passes from tongue to tongue, from brain to brain in current discussions for gospel truth, just as clever counterfeit coins are passed unsuspectingly from hand to hand. The equality superstition is tolerated by clear-seeing men for one reason only. It assists them to govern the thoughts, and by governing the thoughts, to exploit the property, energy, and labor force of all their soft-minded, good-natured neighbors who really believe it to be true, who think it glad tidings of great joy. Behold, when the fraudulent equality of natural rights evangel is mellifluously poured forth in the marketplaces by suave, dollar-hunting attorneys or half-educated mechanics, even those staid citizens, whose life is of it a direct disproof, lead the roaring, raving, yelling crowd in its maniacal bellowings. Lo, the angel of lunacy is camped in their souls. 8. Every atom of organic matter has its own vital peculiarity. Every animate being is different in osseous structure and chemical composition. Ethnology, biology, history, all proclaim equality to be a myth. Even the great epics of antiquity are all glorifications of inequality. Inequality of mind, inequality of birth, of courage, or condition. Can equality of body, equality of mind, equality of origin, equality before the law, or any other kind of damned equality be demonstrated by any one fact? Mentally and morally, every breathing being is a self-poised monad, a differential ego. No two germs, planets, suns, or stars are alike. Among the higher vertebrates, this is especially so, and consequently the only law that men ought to honor or respect is the law that originates and finds its final sanction in themselves, in their own consciousness. Inequality is summed up in the scientific axiom, inferior organisms succumb that superior organisms may survive, propagate, and possess. In other words, the proper place for Lazarus is to rot among the dogs, and the proper place for Caesar is at the head of his irresistible legions. From the soles of his feet to the crown of his head, the bone, skin, and flesh of his body, even the gray brain pulp, the electric nerves and tissues, mental ganglia and internal viscera of a man belonging to the African, Mongolian, Semite, or Negro breeds are all fundamentally different in formation, constituents, and character from the corresponding anatomical sections in men of Aryan descent. The points of non-resemblance may be superficially unperceivable, but they are organic, deep-seated. Notwithstanding the dexterous writers of strategic fables, dross is dross, gold is gold, and some men are born better, born nobler, born braver than others. Aristocracy by birth rests upon an unalterable scientific basis of heredity and selection, but an aristocracy of money rests mainly upon bolts and bars, in example upon laws that may be abrogated at a moment's notice. Though unable to reason out, in logical sequence, their inherent abhorrence of social and racial equality, yet most men instinctively detest it in practice. What white father, for example, would encourage the marriage of a hulking, thick-skulled Negro with his beautiful and accomplished daughter? Would he enthusiastically give her away to the matrimonial embraces of a Chinaman, a coolie, or the leper hugs of a polluted, mean white? Is the 10 such citizens even in North America, where equality of birth and condition is so much speechified and never seen? Is there 5? Is there one who would not rather see the daughter of his loins stiff, stark, and cold in her shroud? Should that one exist, he being of sound mind, let him speak. Then and only then can this diabolical gospel of intrinsic equality be reconsidered. Meanwhile, plain, practical citizens are justified in regarding it not as a self-evident truth, but an insolent, malignant, and abominable lie, a lie that shall yet be stamped out forever with blood and fire. You have only to look at some men to know that they belong to an inferior breed. Take the Negro, for example. His narrow cranial development, his prognathous jaw, his projecting lips, his wide nasal aperture, his simian disposition, his want of forethought, originality, and mental capacity are all peculiarities strictly inferior. Similar language may be applied to the Chinaman, the coolie, the Kanaka, the Jew, and to the rotten-boned city degenerates of Anglo-Saxondom, rich and poor. Vile indeed are the inhabitants of those noxious cattle kraals, London, Liverpool, New York, Chicago, New Orleans. And yet in those places is heaped up the golden plunder of the world. Ethnographers of the very highest authority assert that over 10,000 years ago, the black, white, and yellow types of men-animal were as pronounced and as ineffaceable as they are today. The hieroglyphics and records of ancient tombs and monuments, cuneiform inscriptions, antiquarian researches, and the systematic study of prehistoric skulls and skeletons all bear the same uniform testimony. Inequality of birth and condition can never perish off the earth. Never. And why should it? Who can fill the valleys up and lay the mountains low? 9. Even the giddy doctrinaire who so cunningly concocted the Bombasto Furioso fictions of the Declaration could not apparently have believed them himself. Was he not a slave driver, residing among slave drivers, who bought and anchored human cattle for dollars and cents all the days of his life? No doubt for purposes of statecraft and necessary warcraft, he wove his philosophic preamble of strong deceit. Probably also, he was comparatively honest and even sincere, but among the alluring priests of unreason, the most dangerous is the fanatical propagandist. When Jefferson dictated his fatal and untenable abstraction, he was not even original, but plagiarized Zeno the Stoic, Jack Cade, Savonarola, Milton, Plato, John Ball, etc. Zeno said, all men are by nature equal, but carefully refrained from attempting to demonstrate it. Milton defended it in his prose essays. Plato voiced it in his Republic. John Ball preached it in medieval England. Savonarola perished trying to establish it in Florence. Jack Cade, Robespierre, and Christ were also failures. Ghastly failures. If human experience proves anything at all, writes James Fitzjames Stevens, it proves that if the restraints are minimized, if the largest possible measure of liberty is accorded to all human beings, the result will not be equality, but inequality, reproducing itself in a geometrical ratio. Remove the restraints and see how quickly an aristocracy based on merit would mow down an aristocracy based on credit. In actual life, he who claims equality with another is ever called upon to prove his claim, not by a grotesque abracadabra of silly phrases, parroted from antique philosophers or blue moldy documents, but by actual deeds. That is to say, by producing his credentials. Constitutional theories are all very well to humbug stridulating slaves, but in a free man's household or business they are not legal tender. Among men of affairs, natural egalitarianism is regarded as amusing moonshine, mere spread egoism fit for public meetings only. Business minds thoroughly understand, having learnt by bitter experience, that some men are destined by nature to bear command and some to obey, aye, even for 1,000 years before their birth. No one can study the laborers on a farm, the hands in a big foundry or factory, the seamen in a large seaport, the nomadic hirelings on a railroad construction gang, or the clerks and salesmen in a city warehouse without perceiving at a glance that the vast majority of them are extremely poor specimens of humanity. The ideal type of manhood or womanhood, that is to say, ye thoroughbred, is not to be found among these captive hordes, for captives they really are. Their heads are to a large extent unsymmetrical, their features distorted, ape-like, unintelligent, their bodies are out of all proportion, dwarfed, stunted, diseased, malformed, cretinous. Their movements are contracted, artificial, ungainly, and their minds, outside of routine, are utter vacuums. When compared with the traditional idea of strength, beauty, courage, and nobleness of character, they are an extremely ill-bred herd of cattle, exhibiting all the psychological stigmata of inherited rain rot and of physical decay. A crown of thorns on every brow, that is the wage they're earning now. 9/10 of them are positively repulsive in language, mentality, and in general appearance. They even display an extraordinary low average of animality, and upon the slightest exposure perish off, like sheep that have the lungworm. Heated rooms, woolen clothing, and stimulating beverages are the means whereby their watery blood is kept in languid circulation. Every new generation is feebler and more debased than its predecessor. All the scientific evidences of mental, moral, and bodily deterioration are markedly accentuated in them. Their timidity is proverbial. Hard, continuous, methodical labor destroys courage, saps vitality, and demoralizes character. It tames and subdues men. Just as it tames and subdues the wild steer or the young colt, men who labor hard and continuously have no power to think. It requires all their vital force to keep their muscles in trim. Indeed, the civilized city working man and working woman are the lowest and worst type of animal ever evolved from dust and slime and oxygen. They actually worship work and bow down before law as an ox team crouches and strains under the lash. Look upon their shrunken cheeks, their thin, decayed teeth, sharp, puny noses, small, watery eyes, yellow, bloodless complexions, bent shoulders, dry hair tending to baldness, struggling thin beard, the women with pinched features, waspish, fragile waists, want of bust development, consumptive, neurotic, artificially barren, emaciated, hungry, dwarfed, hysterical. The minds of average workmen and workwomen are either total vacuums or stuffed to the brim with every conceivable species of lies, iniquity, superstition, and sham. Indeed, how could they remain in such conditions of base, loathsome hirelingism? Were they not deficient in all the primitive virtues, in all that is manly or womanly? Behold, upon their brow is stamped with red-hot cattle brands the word damned. Eternally tortured are they in a patent purgatory invented by politicians. Their tribulations, however, may really be but progression in disguise, because their shameful self-degradation must ultimately end in their utter extinguishment. Hopelessly are they entangled in the snare, hopelessly defeated. For them there is no escape. No, not even through fields of blood. Poor trembling wretches, washing their own hands in their own sweat, nay, in their own hearts as blood, born thralls are they, or born madmen. Their days are without hope, and their years are consumed for naught. When their masters speak unto them, there is trembling in all their joints. They waste their lives pursuing shadows, and for hire build their own tombs. Their minds are below freezing point, nay, below zero, crippled souls are they. They knead their own flesh into daily bread, and transmute their contrite hearts into basins of gruel. They look unto idols for deliverance, aye, and grind their dry bones into baskets of coal. At thoughts of battle, they blench with terror. At the sight of naked bayonets, they run like whipped hounds. Therefore strength leapeth down upon them as the panther leaps upon his quarry, and in a moment of time they are blotted out. My soul abhorreth them as an abomination. My hand reacheth out to clutch them by the throat. A people that deliberately enters upon a gigantic war in order to firmly establish a centralized despotism, and at the same time reduce itself to the social level of the Negro, the Russian Jew, the coolie, the Chinaman, and the European serf, must indeed, to use a suggestive vernacularism, have wheels in its head. The man and brother lie has certainly succeeded in writing itself in a constitutional amendment, but in real life it is as far from actuality as ever it was. The free Negro of New Orleans or Charleston is a more degraded, more despised being, and of less money value to his proprietors now than when it was customary to buy and sell him at the auction block instead of as at present on the stock exchange. What the late Civil War really accomplished was to degrade the white slave to the lower level of the plantation nigger, and in that respect it was a triumph of ingenuity. The whites actually fought each other to demonetize themselves. Equality, equality! What brilliant deeds have been perpetrated in thy name! Lincoln, however, was he not a great statesman? Decidedly he was. Well, indeed, he knew how to round up the herd with bewitching phrases. Hark! Do you hear those drunken slaves caterwauling down the street? Lo, it is election night. Hurrah, hurrah, they sing. We'll sound the jubilee. Glory be to Lincoln, the man who made us free. In Morocco, the eunuchs and other menials bless their fate and the prince at the very time he condescends to cut their throats with his own hands. Americans, however, are a free-born people, not to be duped that way. Throughout both northern and southern states, the social chasm between the highest and lowest human organisms, whether white or black and tan, is even more pronounced now than ever it was previously. For example, although the Negroes are a majority in many states, they are never permitted to attain actual administrative power, and they never shall. You cannot paint the Negro white with laws and constitutions, though you write it in fire and smoke of wars and revolutions. To solemnly proclaim that all men are created equal is as stupid and unscientific as to assert that all dogs, cattle, apes, and trees are created equal. Are there not as many diverse varieties of dogs, cattle, apes, and trees as there are of men, planets, germs, stars, and suns? Where then is the intrinsic equality between an oak tree and a currant bush? Between a meddlesome wolfhound and a yelping street cur? Between a buffalo bull and a hand-fed steer? Between an untamable gorilla of the woods and an organ-grinder's castrated monkey? Between a cosmic-trained Bismarck and that famous Christling, the good young man that died? Cannot a blooded bulldog whip a solid score of lean half-starved street mongrels? Upon exactly the same principle, a small body of bold, self-reliant, brainy men are ever more than a match, under any circumstances, for 10,000, nay, 10,000,000 greasy mechanics. What is a mechanic anyhow but a specially trained slave? And it would take the spirit of 1,000 American slaves to make that of one live man. Theoretically, all these organisms are of the same species, but in the savage rush for bread, love, space, and life, there is as much functional difference between them as there is between a royal Bengal tiger and Mary's little lamb. The lamb was made to be eaten, and the tiger was made to eat it, and man was born to struggle as the sparks fly upwards.
Well, how do you like that, boys and girls? That's putting her on the line, baby. That's about it for today. We'll be back with more. Possibly not this, but in a few days we'll be back with Ragnar Redbeard, my favorite guy. 14.5.
Soundbite from a film, True Detective. You might have seen it, Matthew McConaughey, and the other one, I forgot his name, but anyhow, I thought this was pretty amusing, so I cut the clip out of the film. Run it for you. And I forgot to tell you, this was these two detectives had gone to this tent revival meeting. They're looking for a guy. But the conversation between the two detectives is very interesting. One is agnostic, maybe atheist, pretty logically speaking. The other one's sort of nominal Christian, but he's a rounder, he's a whoremonger, he's a drunk. So let's listen to this interplay between these two detectives as they're standing at the back of this crowd out of nowhere's land in a revival tent.
Where is Chef D said the church burned down 4 months earlier. No prince put out an APB on Friends of Christ. A week later, they were in Franklin. Revival ministry. Old time religion. You can imagine what Mr. Charisma thought of that. Forget the average IQ that this group is, huh? Can you see Texas up there on your high horse? What do you know about these people? Just observation and deduction. See a propensity for obesity, poverty, a yen for fairy tales. Folks putting what few bucks they do have in the little wicker baskets being passed around. I think it's safe to say that nobody here is going to be splitting the atom, Marty. You see that? Your fucking attitude. Not everybody wants to sit alone in an empty room beating off the murder manuals. Some folks enjoy community, the common good.
Yeah, but the common good's got to make up fairy tales, and it's not good for anybody.
Your sorrows came you to this place. They divide you from what your heart knows. And there are a lot of good hearts out there. I'm looking out there. I'm seeing a lot of good hearts out there. I'm seeing a lot of good hearts out there.
I mean, can you imagine if people didn't believe what the things they get up to? Exact same thing they do now, just out in the open. Bullshit. It'd be a fucking freak show of murder and debauchery, and you know it. It's the only thing keeping a person decent is the expectation of divine reward, and brother, that person is a piece of shit. And I'd like to get as many of them out in the open as possible. I guess your judgment is infallible, piece of shit wise. You think that notebook is a stone tablet? What's it say about life? You gotta get together. Tell yourself stories that violate every law of the universe. Just skip in the goddamn day. What's that say about your reality, Marty? When you get to talking like this, you sound panicked.
You think it's all a scam, huh?
Mm.
All them folks?
Mm-hmm.
They just wrong?
Oh, yeah. Been that way since one monkey looked at the sun and told the other monkey, he said, for you to give me your fucking share. People. So goddamn frail, they'd rather put a coin in a wishing well than buy dinner.
Jesus Christ, your arms open and closed. The echoes of my life can never contain to see the truth about you. You move the feather in the ash, you touch the leaf with its flames.
Transference of fear and self-loathing to an authoritarian vessel. It's catharsis. He absorbs their dread with his narrative. Because of this, he's effective in proportion to the amount of certainty he can project. Certain linguistic anthropologists think that religion is a language virus that rewrites pathways in the brain, dulls critical thinking.
Well, I don't use $10 words as much as you, but for a guy who sees no point in existence, you sure fret about it an awful lot. And you still sound panicked.
At least I'm not racing to a red light.